Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's afternoon satsang. As always, this is Prem, and with me is Arvind. And we are here to begin another fortnight of our Bhagavat Vahini satsang. And it's been a couple of weeks, more than a couple of weeks, since we stopped the story, where at the point where the Yajna was being contemplated as a remedy for all that has happened during the Mahabharata war, and that's the point where we were, where the court headed by Lord Krishna himself was deliberating on, you know, what is the right course of action after having gone through that very, very painful war at the Kurukshetra. But before all that, we offer our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet, and I invite Brother Arvind to join all of us. Saram Arvind.
Saram Prem, as you said, it has been more than a fortnight since we stopped the Bhagavata Vahini. So, a quick recap of the story so far, or at least what we covered in the last fortnight. As you said, this is happening currently in the court of Hastinapura, where Lord Krishna is also present. Just now, the naming ceremony of the child has been performed. The child has been named as Parikshit, the grandson of the Pandavas, or is it the great-grandson?
Yeah. He is the great-grandson.
The great-grandson of the Pandavas. He has been named Parikshit. The grandson of the Pandavas.
Abhimanyu's son.
So, he has been named
really as... a long while.
Yeah. So, he has been named as Parikshit. And then, after the naming ceremony, when everybody is in a joyous and festive mood, that is when Yudhishthira begins to lament on how bad he is feeling about the entire Kurukshetra war that has taken place. He is unable to enjoy any of the prosperity or the rule or anything that comes with him being the victor, because he is aware of the kind of terrible things, tragedies that have occurred during the war, and he is seeking for some. He is seeking some solace. The wisdom that Lord Krishna showers on him, saying that when you do it as your duty, there is nothing wrong. There's nothing to feel bad about. That doesn't seem to placate him. And therefore, sage Vyasa, who mentions in the court, gives him an advice on how it can be nullified by doing the Ashwamedha Yajna. That is what we were discussing. And Yudhishthira, he says that just a Ashwamedha Yajna also will not suffice. Because he says, I have committed three kinds of sins, which makes this war more sinful than any other war in the history of mankind. And what are the three sins? He says, the first thing is, in this war I have killed kinsmen. Usually a war is against an enemy kingdom. He says, it was not against an enemy kingdom, it was against my own kinsmen. I have killed my family in this war. Then, I have killed my own gurus and venerable elders. I have killed teachers, preceptors. I have killed whom I am supposed to revere and worship. Such people have been killed. That is the second reason why this war becomes sinful. And the third reason is, this has been a war where multiple crowned heads have fallen. Usually in a war between King A and King B, one king dies. So, it is considered like the king is the parent for the whole kingdom, and when the king dies, the kingdom is orphaned. Here, multiple kings have died. So, he has orphaned multiple kingdoms, meaning thousands and thousands of people. So, Yudhishthira says, on this account, this was not an ordinary war. It's a triply more devastating war. And therefore, he says, in order to atone for it or make up for it, I should do not just one Ashwamedha Yajna, but a yajna that is triply placating. And therefore, it has been decided that three Ashwamedha Yajnas will be performed. And this is what Yudhishthira announces when Krishna interrupts him.
Right. And at this point, actually, Krishna brings up a very, very important point. In fact, it is mentioned in many of the historical accounts that there are different ways by which kings impose on their subjects undue economic pressure. One thing is, of course, the war, right? And that's what has gone through, I mean, in this part of the thing. And there were other kings who would, you know, build huge infrastructure for themselves, like, you know, huge palaces at the cost of the people. That was, again, one more type. And there was another type where there would be constant yajnas and sacrifices, rituals being performed at the cost of the people. Because even for that, the expense for yajnas, if done properly, you know, we've seen yajnas being performed in Swami's presence, if they have to be done properly, if the gifts which go with it have to be given, the number of pujaris who are meant to be in a proper yajna have to be appointed and have to be
paid
the right amounts, it costs a lot. Right? It costs a lot. And that's what Krishna says, that, you know, you've just had a war now, and you had a war where all your vassal kings have participated, and all of them have borne enormous amounts of expense at the cost because of the war. And now you want to do a yajna, and not just one yajna, you want to do it, you know, three times. Imagine what will be the expense of that, and where are you going to get the money from? And it is absolutely not right on the part of your king, on the part of the king, to squeeze that money out of the subjects. Because that's the only way out, right? You know, where does the king get
its
money?
You tax the subjects.
He says it's not right, because already, you know, they have gone through, because all the, you know, men in the army who had died, all of them come from the subjects, you know. It's not only the kings who have died, but many of those subjects would have lost, you know, breadwinners in that sense. So Krishna says it's absolutely not right to draw money in the form of taxes from the people.
In our current state in India today, I think we can very much empathize with the conditions, because recently we had our budget announced, and in the budget there was a slight easing of taxes, and that happened because a few months back we had this whole demonetization exercise where two important high denomination currency notes were removed from circulation, removed from legal tender. So we can understand how it would have been if in this budget additional taxes had been imposed on us. Everyone in the country would have felt the pain, because everyone had this feeling that we are already reeling under the onslaught of this demonetization. Now you're coming and adding extra taxes. So I say we can definitely empathize with what Lord Krishna is saying, because just now the war has concluded, and now I'm looking forward to times of prosperity and some happiness to come. And if the king, the emperor comes and starts saying that I'll have to levy more taxes because I'm performing not one Ashwamedha Yagna but three, it's definitely going to tick off the people.
And it's because you are guilty about it, right?
Yes.
Because, you know, the sages are saying there's nothing wrong in what you've done. What you've done is dharma. Krishna is saying what you've done is in dharma, but something is eating you from within, and to probably satisfy that restlessness, doing something like this would be wrong. And I think we made a mention of that even the last time when we were speaking, the difference between Arjuna and Yudhishthira. Because Krishna is having to do here what exactly he had to do just before the war with respect to Arjuna. Because Arjuna asked these questions and, you know, was worried about all of these emotions
before he
entered into the war. And Swami would say that's why he actually, you know, deserved to get the Bhagavad Gita even more than Yudhishthira, who was supposed to be the most noble among the Pandavas.
And Swami would term this as the difference between Purva Tapa and Paschatapa.
Right.
Purva Tapa is the... Tapa basically is some kind of a...
Repentance.
Repentance. It also is a kind of a discontent.
Right.
It's some kind of situation where you're uncomfortable. So, when you start feeling uncomfortable before actually doing the deed, that is called Purva Tapa. When you feel this after having committed the deed, it's called Paschatapa.
Right.
Paschatapa is like crying over spilt milk, and so Krishna says, Swami says it's of no use. That's why in comparison to Yudhishthira, Arjuna stands out, and as you said...
And it's actually a very, very important message that Swami gives. No, here, of course, you know, the case is what they did was not wrong, be it Arjuna or Yudhishthira, because Krishna has approved of it.
Mm.
He says that you might feel guilty, you might feel sorry, but what you've done is not wrong. But in many times in life, this is what we do. You know, Swami says that you have to think before you act. But what we do is, we act and we say that if anything goes wrong, we can actually, you know, repair it by a concept in Indian culture called, doing in this kind of yajnas. There's a word for that. Pariharams.
Pariharam.
Right? You do pariharams and get away. You know, you didn't think before you did it, and you were not conscious, you didn't use your discrimination before you did it. And after the mess has been created, you think that you can do a pariharam and you can get away with it. And Swami was saying, I mean, the very idea that Swami was saying that Arjuna was better than Yudhishthira in this fact is that always Purva Tapam is the right way rather than Paschatapam.
In fact, I remember one of the discourses that we played for the Shankranti last 2 years, or I don't know, Shankranti or Convocation, in which Swami is saying when you commit a mistake, don't seek forgiveness for it from God.
Right.
He says, be ready. You have done the mistake. Tell the Lord that you are ready to go through the karma. Because, you know, this is also something we have discussed in different satsangs, that in a spiritual parlance, you can't nullify a negative with a positive. It's not like I do a dark deed and I do a good deed to compensate for it and therefore my karma is nullified. No. When you do a dark deed followed by a good deed, you get the fruits of the dark deed and of the good deeds.
Right.
It is not like that kind of accounting where minus 1 plus 1 becomes 0. Minus 1 and plus 1 remain minus 1 and plus 1 and you have to go through minus 1 and plus 1. Which means irrespective of how much ever good I do or how much ever I repent, the reactions to the actions I have performed I have to go through. And that's why Swami would say don't seek escape from them from Swami. Instead, pray that they should come to you, because there's a beautiful divine logic in that also. What better time to work out our karmas than in the presence and support of the Lord? Because I don't think we can perform better any other scenario. And that is how, if we look at Swami's life also, it has been like that. You know, I'm reminded of the story of Kalpagiri, the person who murdered his wife and ran away and became a monk, and he was even being respected and revered by people in the Himalayas as a monk. But when he came to Swami, Swami told him, no, you go surrender to the police and face whatever you have to for the deed that you have done. He said to Swami that, Swami, they are going to put a noose around my neck. Swami assured him that that would not happen. And Swami said, I promise you that you finish this karma and come back, I will put a rosary around your neck. That's precisely what happened. He gets a presidential pardon. And so, coming back to this, therefore, whenever we do some mistake or something, let's not think of escaping. Let us own up, let us realize, become aware of the mistake and be ready to face the consequences, knowing that the Lord is with us always.
And exactly, and that is the very, very subtle difference between, you know, after doing a mistake, taking responsibility for that and blaming yourself for that. Both sound very similar or appear very similar, but it's very different. When you take responsibility, you know, you move ahead. You don't, you blame yourself and remain in the past, as Swami would say. But when you take responsibility, you kind of gather the situation together and then see what is there to be done forward, rather than blaming yourself or blaming anybody else.
Yeah, and, blaming is destructive while responsibility is constructive.
Exactly. But, you know, the reason why Krishna was allowing Yudhishthira to do what he's doing right now of, you know, openly repenting, he knows that this is really not something so deep that Krishna cannot remove it, right? You know, we've seen that Yudhishthira was not obsessed with his pain, as we are going to see, you know, in the conversation which follows. He's just expressing what is right on top of his mind. As, I mean, it's understandable, you know, we see a 3-hour movie on the World War II, I'm sure we will lose our appetite for dinner that day,
mm-hmm.
or probably even the next day. And that's what it is when you even watch something which is so gory. Imagine being a part of a war where you've seen so many people being decimated and you've seen kings and, you know, hundreds and thousands of women being widowed. It's quite understandable that Yudhishthira is having this feeling. You know, even having the Lord beside you and telling that you've not done anything wrong, nothing to worry, will not so easily lift that gloom. Right? So it's understandable that Yudhishthira is doing what he's doing.
And when Krishna tells this to Yudhishthira, saying that, how could you simply announce like this in open assembly? If you had at least consulted me, the elders, we could have thought of doing something. You have just announced it like you are undertaking 3 Ashwamedha Yagnas. Now, how are you going to finance it? Are you going to tax the already burdened citizens? So when Krishna tells this, let's not forget, Yudhishthira is called Dharmaja, Dharma Raja, the emperor of Dharma. And he is the only one among the Pandavas who could go to heaven with his earthly body because no adharma has been committed by his body. So he is not an ordinary being. So when Krishna tells this to him, Dharmaja goes back to his recourse, which is total surrender. He tells Krishna, Krishna, I have expressed, as you said, Krishna, I have expressed what is foremost in my mind. But I am not saying this is the thing. If you say there are no yagnas, there is no need of any yagnas. If you say we should do not just 3, but we should do multiple yagnas, I am ready for that. But let me tell you this much, Krishna, that I am not worried. Why should I be worried when I have you, the Kalpataru, the Kalpavriksha, the wish-fulfilling tree? Nothing is impossible for you. So I am not going to get worried that I have to do 3 Ashwamedha Yagnas, where do I get the money for it from? Because Krishna, I know I have you. When I have you, I am not worried about anything else. So, you know, this surrender to Krishna, where he doesn't have joys or fears of his own, because everything, he's totally reliant on Krishna. I think Krishna asked this question to Yudhishthira also to show to the entire populace why Dharmaraja is Dharmaraja. Because in spite of being the master, he's the emperor, he's the Chakravarti, he's not just a ruler of a kingdom. He's the ruler of all the rulers. All are subservient to him. He's the emperor of the earth, he's having everything, he's having all the riches. And in being in that position, you know, when he says that, hey Lord, I am not a decision maker, I am a nobody. You are everyone, you decide, I have no problems. That's why I can speak like this. It's easy to be humble when you are not in power, when you don't have friends, when you don't have money. But true humility is when you can do what you like, you can do what you wish, and yet you say that it is not my wish, it is his wish.
And also, as you were saying, he is the king of the kings, he is the emperor of the realm, and he has got brothers unmatchable in valor, like, you know, Bhima and Arjuna and all of this, and he's got a huge army which is now, I'm sure, would have been established as the most impregnable army in the entire subcontinent. But with all of this, his confidence is not from any of that. His confidence is, you know, Krishna, you are there, I don't have to worry about anything. And
wow, you know, I think that is a lesson we really should learn, because it doesn't matter, as the Bhajagovindam says, Harati Nimeshat Kala Sarvam. In a moment,
change life
time
changes.
Can just change everything. It can take away your wealth. So let's not make wealth, influence, property, relationships or whatever, power, as the basis of our self-confidence. Let the basis of our confidence, let the basis of our joy be something that is permanent, eternal. And that is nothing but Lord Krishna, our own Swami.
And even historically, you know, that's why if you read some of these New Age mythologists who write about all these epics, you know, they write it with a little bit of the tinge of historic nature of what was the state of the kingdoms in those times and all of that. And that's when, if you see comparatively, the kingdom of Dwaraka was tiny compared to the kingdom of Indraprastha or, you know, Hastinapura. The Kuru dynasty, I mean, even when you see the descriptions, it's actually, that is almost like a tribal, settlement.
Sheftans, Yadava Sheftans.
They only called as Sheftans, and they all come together to form one kingdom. But Kuru dynasty is supposed to be a huge kingdom. So even in that sense, here is the emperor of the Kuru dynasty, who's saying that I'm not worried because Krishna, you're there, and who's not even the king of that small, vassal kingdom of his.
Talking of Yudhishthira's surrender, it is surrender that keeps you equanimous in the face of joy and grief. This equanimity is so important, because equanimity gives us the ability to see things as they are, rather than getting clouded by our own emotion. Recently, I was speaking with our English teacher from the higher secondary school, Bijoy Kumar Mishra sir. Okay. Mishra sir, whom we call as Mishra sir. And he has been struck with polio right since birth, and he's always been on the crutches. He was narrating about how he first came to Swami. It was amazing. In the year 1967, that is when he came to Swami. And cutting a long story short, he was the eldest in a family of eight, and he was discontented with everything in the world. He was searching for that something, getting which you get everything, and that something is only available in the spiritual realms. And he read through all the available books, and still he was not satisfied. That is when, in the Illustrated Weekly of India, he happened to read an article on Swami, 1964 edition, written by Dr. Sundar Rao, who was also the first warden of the Vrindavan campus of our university. So having read that, he felt the need and urge to see Swami. He just ran away from home. He ran away from home, came to Perth. It's a beautiful long story. And what happened was, finally, when he actually got the chance of an interview with Swami, all his questions were answered, everything happened. But he says, he finally told Swami that, Swami, how do you expect me to go back home now? Because I don't have any money. He had come with only 10 rupees, ticketless. He had not bought tickets. He said that, I am going to take a leap of faith. If you, my guru, my God, my providence, whoever you are, if you can't take care of my journey for 3 days, how will you take care of my life journey? So with that kind of confidence, you know, he had just jumped into a train, and he came with just that. Now when he had to go back home, he was now telling, okay, now Swami, tell me, how do you want me to go back home? Like, because he knows somewhere in his heart that ticketless travel is not right. But now, so he asks, and Swami says, I will give you the money, you don't worry. So quickly, sir was saying that he made a calculation that he needed 35 rupees to get back to his home in Cuttack, Orissa, from Puttaparthi. He had to change 5 trains and reach Cuttack. And Swami came and gave him a bundle of notes. So he accepted it, came out, and then when he started counting, see, right now he's penniless. He has nothing except the money that Swami has given.
Mm-hmm.
So when he opened, he saw there were 3 10-rupee notes. There was 1 2-rupee note and 1 1-rupee note. 33 rupees. 2 rupees less than what he needs to get back to his home.
Mm-hmm.
That's only the ticket cost. What about his food? What about all these? So he was thinking, how could Swami make a mistake like this? Because, you know, by now his experience with Swami was such that he was convinced that this is not just my guru, but something more. He's my everything. He's my mother. He's my father. In fact, he looks to Swami as his father.
Mm-hmm.
He is my provider. He'll give me everything. So he was wondering, how could he make this mistake? How could Swami give me only 32 rupees? Minimum he should have given me 35. But because he was convinced of who Swami is, he said, no, Swami could not have made the mistake. I mean, this is where I feel surrender comes in. He felt, no, this is not a mistake. This is not a mistake. This is the right thing. 32 rupees is exactly what I need. Why did Swami give this? Which means, possibly Swami does not want me to go home. Because if he wanted me to go home, he'll give me 35 rupees. So he said, okay, so 32 rupees is for me to subsist here. Okay, so he stayed on, and the very next day, another gentleman comes and tells him about, you know what, come what may, next 1 week, don't leave Puttaparthi. He says, why? He says, because Mahashivratri is coming. What is Mahashivratri? It is a festival when Swami does Lingodbham and Vibhuti Abhishekam. What is Lingodbham? What is Vibhuti Abhishekam? You know, all this he discovered, and he had a beautiful 3 weeks in Prashantanilayam, which actually changed his life. So he says, you know, at that point in time, I'm grateful to Swami that he gave me this kind of thought that he can't do anything wrong. This is the right thing. I have to see what to do with this. Because of which, I have gained whatever I am today. And today, of course, he's a teacher. He has spent 50 years at the lotus feet. That's a long story. But see, that equanimity comes from surrender. And what is surrender? Surrender is nothing but thinking that whatever happens is good for me because Swami can't do anything wrong for me. So this is good for me. So this is right for me. So therefore, I change my thinking to match the fact that this is good for me. And that makes you actually see things which you would have otherwise missed. Just like he was able to see that this is a way that I can stay with Swami, witness my first Lingodbham, witness the first Vibhuti Abhishekam, and have a life-transforming experience. I think that equanimity is something that Yudhishthira has developed always. And he has always exhibited that, and it is that equanimity that makes him speak like this to Krishna, which, of course, equanimity always thrills the Lord's heart. That is what Krishna has also said, right? That he is a true devotee who is sukha dukhe same kritva. So equanimity pleases Krishna's heart, and therefore Krishna himself comes out with a solution for Yudhishthira.
Absolutely. And you know, when this episode happens of Yudhishthira telling Krishna that I'm not worried about the wherewithal because you are there, you know how many times we have turned to Swami and Swami would point out, I don't even have a pocket in my robe. You know, that's what Swami would say. Jebe lede, Swami used to say. You know, that was Swami. And I mean, how often have we seen Swami carrying money or, you know, having something in his hand? It would always be somebody handing it to him. He would go inside. But we knew that he was the source of everything. Everything just had to come when he asked for it. And that's the same thing. You know, I'm reminded of an incident which one of the teachers were telling. It was during this, water project time. And many times Swami himself has spoken about it. He emptied all the accounts of the Central Trust and there was nothing left. That's how the water project was done. And apparently when Swami was in Kodai or something, somebody comes in, one of the office bearers come and tells Swami that, Swami, there's no money left. And we have to pay the salaries, you know, in the ashram and in the institute. And there's no money left for that. And Swami is saying, yeah, it'll come, don't worry, somebody will send, you know. It has to come, it'll come at that time, okay. And he was saying, no, Swami, it's a big amount, it's not like, you know, few thousands or something. So Swami said, how much is it? So they said, Swami, it's about 11 lakhs. So Swami, you know, picked up a bundle of letters which was there and randomly picked up one envelope and gave it to them. and it was a check for 11 lakhs. Some devotee has sent it, you know, as an offering to Swami. So in that sense, you know, where is, when one thing is equanimity of that ability, that thought that whatever Swami does is good for me, and the other thing is, there is nothing that this Lord cannot do. So there is no question of Him not doing something because He is not able to do it. If He is not doing it, it's not meant to be done. Right?
Exactly.
And that is what makes this equanimity, as you're saying, one thing is whatever Swami does is good for me and He can do anything at any time. This together makes that equanimity so strong. And that's what these people have seen. In fact, there's that beautiful conversation in the depiction of the Ramayana, they say, where Duryodhana is very, very confident that they will not lose the battle because they have Bhishma. And Bhishma cannot be killed by anybody unless he wants to die.
Hmm.
Right? He has the Ichha Mrityu. And Krishna tells, you keep watching, we will defeat him also. You know, we will put him also down, and that's what happens in a manner which nobody thought would, you know, things would pan out. And when the Pandavas have continuously seen this happen, and the episodes which Swami narrates about Durvasa and his 1,000 disciples, how with a leaf actually Krishna satisfies all of their hunger. So all of this experience, you know, it is a combination of you first having faith, which is strengthened by experience, and that experience leads to more faith, and that faith actually brings in more experience.
See, that is a very important statement, because we often think that it is experience that gives the faith. It is not like that. It is also the faith, because I'm stating a very simple thing that we would have experienced in our own different ways in our lives. Like if you take that example of 11 lakhs, for example. So Swami picked out and gave 11 lakhs. Usually what that will lead to is, next time there's a problem of a 10 lakh deficit or 11 lakh deficit, we'll feel, hey, don't worry, man. Swami is there, you know, Swami is there. What, 11 lakhs, no problem. But what if the deficit becomes 1 crore? What if the deficit becomes 100 crore? What if the deficit becomes 1,500 crores? We feel, you know what, 11 lakhs, and all Swami did, because, yeah, somebody is there
because
to donate 11 lakhs.
That devotee can send a check for,
yeah,
11 lakhs.
Yeah, he can again send 12 lakhs, 13 lakhs. But 1,500 crores, how, yaar? How, means this is real problem. See, our faith gets, our faith or whatever is very quantified. I pray something and I get, and I feel, you know what, when if I pray for vibhuti from Swami, I'll get. But curing my mother's cancer, how, yaar? I mean, we always impose, extrapolate our own limitations onto the Lord. So that is one danger. That's why I say it is not just the experience. I mean, if it is only experience, going back to that incident where, for example, Mishra sir needed 35 rupees. If it is only experience that gives everything, if Swami had provided him 40 rupees at that moment, suppose, then throughout life, never one should worry about anything else. Whether it's, as I said, whether it's 40 or 40,000 or 40 lakhs or 40 crores. But it is not like that. For us, yanta matramu evra talachina, like that, how they say that, depending on my capacity, if I have received this much, I feel Swami can solve up to this much. But when it's 20 times this, what will Swami do? I need one more experience for 20 times that. I need one more experience for 20,000 times that. So therefore, experience definitely reinforces and strengthens, but there is no substitute for our own faith.
And the problem is, you know, when your experience, when your faith is completely based only on experience, then you'll have to factor in the other experience also, like the
negative ones.
Right?
When Swami didn't apparently answer.
Like the story that you said, you know, if 33 rupees, if you have to factor in that experience without the faith, it will be like, oh, Swami has done a mistake.
Or Swami couldn't give 35, yeah, he could do only 32.
Right.
So you know what, I'll solve 90% of your problem, 10% you somehow take care, come
right.
on, I'm doing this much. It looks like that.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, the ability to say that there is nothing that cannot be done by him, and if it is not done, it's not done for a certain reason. And as you're saying, dwell on that reason. If it has to be revealed to you, it will be revealed to you.
Because here now, Krishna is going to reveal a source of wealth that will be very easy, which can very comfortably take care of 3 Ashwamedha Yagnas. Like, if, without faith, if you see, where was this Krishna when actually I was struggling for food in the forest? And when I'm needing it, you're not providing me one morsel of food. Now when I actually don't need, means I'm pretty well off now. I'm doing well, I'm a ruler of the kingdom. You're providing me this much more. So, that's why faith becomes so important, and Krishna tells that several years, centuries ago, there was a mighty ruler called Marut. This Marut had performed a magnificent yagna, one like which has never been performed ever since. And during that yagna, he gave away so much gold to all the people who attended that when they had to return back to their own kingdoms, to their own cities, they did not have enough capacity to carry that much gold. So most of the gold, they discarded it and took back only a little. He says all the discarded gold near Marut city actually lies buried. I'll exactly point out that location. You will, if you go there, you will be able to dig out all that gold, and that wealth would be more than sufficient to perform 3 Ashwamedha Yagnas, and it will also not lead to any kind of dissatisfaction among the people, because you will not have to tax them even one cowrie pie. And this is what the solution he gives to Yudhishthira. But Yudhishthira, being an embodiment of dharma, or possibly as a spokesperson for the rest of humanity, has one more final doubt to put to the Lord.
Right, he says, you know, here we are trying to do a yajna, which is meant to be a form of repentance, and how can we do it on somebody else's wealth? You know, I should be doing it out of my own effort. How can I take the wealth which was given to somebody else as a gift and go and collect that and do a, you know, a yajna with that? Again, Krishna explains that that's not the case, because these people have, you know, willfully, knowing what they were actually giving up, knowing what they were letting go, they discarded this wealth on the way, and for generations have passed and none of their people in their lineage know about this wealth. And even if they know, it does not belong to them, because it has been discarded and it has gone under the earth. And we know even now the Endowments Act, what is found under the ground, especially gold, belongs to the government. And he says, as a ruler, you have a right over that which is found under the ground. So you don't have to have any qualms about using that.
Absolutely. If I find gold in my courtyard, doesn't mean I can keep the gold.
Right.
It has to go to the government. It has to go to the ruler of the land. And that is what Krishna is telling here.
But it's a complete aside, but talking about endowments and finding gold under the ground, I'm reminded of that famous incident which happened in Dwaraka when Swami went. You know, when Swami
yes.
had been to Dwaraka,
yes,
he went
yes.
to the
sands,
the seashore actually. It was not the riverbed, it was the seashore where Swami went. And as right. usual, as what Swami would do in Chitravati, he started making a mound. And then he brought out this 1.5 feet almost golden statue of Krishna. It's a very, very famous and beautiful picture of Swami sitting with that
golden
statue
idol
on his lap. And apparently there was a lot of people around, and Swami asked each one of them, what is this? So they said, Swami, it's a statue. Swami, it's a golden statue. They said, Swami, it's a this, that. Swami was not happy with any of those answers. And apparently just then the Rajmata had come. And Swami asked Rajmata of Jamnagar, you know, Swami asked her, you know, what is this statue? And she said, Swami, this is my Krishna. She did not say it's a statue. She did not say it's gold. She said, ye to mera kanhaiya hai. She said, this is my Krishna. And Swami looked at all the others and said, you all fellows saw the gold. It was only she who saw Lord Krishna in what I've created. So this belongs to her, and gives it to her. And by the time they reached the palace, this news has spread that Sai Baba came and he unearthed some golden statue from under the ground. And it seems apparently immediately, of course, we'll skip the first part where the archaeological survey department lands up. But the next one to come is the endowments department, because they found that somebody has found gold under the ground.
It belongs to the government.
It belongs to the government. So they said, and they wanted to take possession of the statue. And Rajmata was very, very upset. And when they asked Swami, Swami said, no problem, let them take it. You know, they will test it, they will check it, and then they'll give it back to you. So they took the statue, and for almost 1 day, 2 day, calls were going back and forth from Delhi to US, and they were trying to do all these kind of tests. At the end of the day, they came and gave it back to Rajmata and said, you know, you can keep it. So she said, why, you don't want it? He said, no, because it's not gold at all. Okay. Then she went and reported this to Swami. Swami, this is what they're saying. They're saying it's not gold. Swami said, don't leave them, ask them what metal it is. Right? So they went back to those scientists and said, what metal it is? So in a very, very humbled manner, they said, I say, that's the whole problem. We're not able to make out what metal it is. We have tested it for all the metals. We know it's unknown. So we've decided it's better not to mess with Swami. You can keep the statue. And the story goes that later when they checked with the royal jeweler, he said, this is the purest form of gold you can, you know, ever find and make anything out of.
Just curious to know about the current location of the idol or something.
Right. No, I don't know. I think it must be with the family, of course.
Maybe we should try to contact them and have a look. Yeah, so coming back to the gold, yes. So this is what Krishna tells. And, you know, when we spoke, another thought that came in my mind is about when these Brahmins gave up gold. See, I was reminded of this different Vairagyas that Swami speaks about. Vairagya is detachment. So, Swami says that detachment, you cannot consider some examples Swami gives and says, these are not detachment, these are only temporary detachments.
Right.
And one is called the Smashana Vairagya. Smashana Vairagya is when you feel that I need not pursue anything when you are actually attending a funeral, because you see the ultimate end for everything is this. So why should I try to amass wealth? Why should I try to, you know, grow relations? Why? Because finally I'm going to end up like this. That is a detachment that you get at the burial ground alone. Because the next day, you're back to your business going about your work.
And Swami would say, the moment you come out of the crematorium, so what shall we have for lunch?
That's
exactly. Why your Vairagya sinks.
So that's all. So that's a temporary Vairagya. So like that, there are five. I think Smashana Vairagya, Abhava Vairagya, Udara Vairagya, Purana Vairagya, and Prasuti Vairagya.
Yes.
So Prasuti Vairagya is the detachment a mother gets when she delivers the child. The amount of pain she goes through, she feels, no, I don't want any of this again. Then the Purana Vairagya is the detachment you get when you listen to Bhagwan's discourses or the scriptures. You listen to that and you feel, why am I chasing the world? I was reminded of Udara Vairagya actually. Udara Vairagya is the detachment you get when you have an excess of something. You just had 4 parotas. Somebody comes and tells 20 parotas waiting for you. You say, no, who wants to eat parotas? Parotas I don't want. You're saying that now because you've had 4 and you're having a plenty. 3 days later when you're hungry, you will hunger for the same parota. So you cannot say that I have overcome my desire or wanting for parota simply because I don't want to eat it now. Because that is the problem of plenty. And so, when we have these Brahmins discarding that gold and going, I mean, I don't think we should mistake into thinking that these are all great renunciants who are not bothered about gold. When there is an excess, you're not bothered. And that's what happens in the real world also. When there's a surplus, the demand falls, the prices fall. And when there's a shortage, the prices escalate. So, it is as temporary as that. True Vairagya is knowingly giving it up without any of these external factors. Finally, one more we missed is Abhava Vairagya.
Mm-hmm.
Abhava Vairagya is opposite of Udara Vairagya. Abhava Vairagya is when you know that you can't get it at all.
Grapes are sour.
The grapes are sour. Yeah, you know you can't get it and you say, I don't care, I don't want. You know, it's like me telling, who cares about going and walking on moon? I'm not interested. I am detached. I don't want to. It's because guess what? How much ever I try now, when I look in the near future, there's no way I can go to the moon. So I say that I'm not interested in the moon. So I was just reminded of these different temporary Vairagyas that Swami speaks of when I read about how the Brahmin just threw away gold and walked away.
And the other thing which, you know, strikes me is the sequence of events. You know, first of all, as Yudhishthira is saying, that he feels that he has done something wrong and he needs to do something. Let's for the time's sake, you know, accept that there's something wrong and some form of repentance has to be done. And he has no idea what to do. You know, first of all, he has no idea. He's getting a suggestion from all the people and they say, okay, you can do a yajna. And even that, you know, imagine that there was no Krishna in the scene. There is no Lord in the scene. You've done a mistake. You want to repent for it. And you go and ask some experts what to do. And they give you a solution. And even then, you don't know whether it's going to work or not. You know, you're just only going to do it for your own self-satisfaction. And even then, there could be any number of obstacles. You don't know how are you going to go through it. I think this is what happens when grace comes into the picture. Because many times when we talk about grace, we ask, I don't know if others ask, but I get this idea, is grace also part of the karmic cycle? Right? Suppose I have a problem and as a beautiful Sai coincidence, somebody comes, a friend or a devotee comes and solves it. You know, sometimes you get this doubt, was it really Swami's grace which came in that form? Or was it part of my karma that I had to, this problem had to be solved that way? Right? And that's a question which always comes. I think when an avatar comes and a situation like this happens, he says that, you know, he can come in and modify karma in a way where, you know, you still are doing the same things. You know, you've done a bad act, then you're doing a good act, you'll reap benefit from that good act. But what to do, when to do, and how to do, that's when the Lord's grace comes in and modifies the whole thing. Because there is no other way they could have you know, got this piece of information that there is this King Marut who did this, you know, sacrifice, and there's so much of gold here. That could have never happened if not for the grace of the Lord coming in. And that's really what happens, you know, when Swami says, I don't meddle with nature, I don't meddle with the laws of nature. Many times, Swami need not meddle, even that mere presence and directing the right way. I think that is what is grace. That's what Swami would do. Swami did not tell that, now you become a devotee, all your problems will be solved. But I will start guiding your life in such a way that at the right time, what needs to be done will be done, and what right time, what you need to get, you will get.
When Swami says that your problems will be gone, it doesn't mean that these situations don't arise, but this much is definitely sure that they'll no longer be problems.
Right.
It's like saying that I don't destroy my enemies, I just destroy the enmity. When the enmity is gone, they're no longer enemies. In that sense, when Swami says that once they're no longer problems, if you don't view them as problems, they're as good as solved. So that is what Krishna tells them over here, and the armies are sent, the gold is fetched, and massive preparations for the yagna begin, and a piece of land next to the river Ganges is selected, the area is leveled, constructions come up, there's a lot of, I mean, beautifully Swami has described as to all the decorations that go in and how the whole place becomes festive in readiness for the yagna, and the yagna is about to begin. But I think before we begin the yagna, we'll take a quick break over here. Dear listeners, here is a little break, on the other side of which we will continue with the Bhagavata Vahini.
Sundaravadana
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about the yajna which Yudhishthira was about to perform. Not one, but three yajnas. Before we go to that, you know, of course, we said there's a huge description that Swami gives about the Yajnashala and the preparations which happen. But, you know, coming to think of it, I don't know, Swami doesn't mention which era this king Marut belongs to.
Mm.
But, you know, there's a description that Swami gives that Lord Indra himself presided over the yajna, and that yajna was matchless. But I'm sure that, you know, in the grandeur apart, he must have done it with real feeling, because the offerings that he made in that yajna are being used by an yajna which is being presided over by Lord Krishna himself. You know, it's almost like the story of the Govardhanagiri, where Swami would say that it got left out during the Ramayana but gets the opportunity during Krishna's...
To serve the Lord.
Serve the Lord. And literally it's like that. Hundreds and thousands of years must have passed after this yajna, but it still gets this honor of being a part in a different way of the yajna which is being performed, you know, headed by Krishna himself. But when this thing is about to start, the chief pujari comes to Yudhishthira and says, you know, you have taken the sankalpa of doing three Ashwamedha yajnas. So we would like to know whether you want to do three one after the other, or there is a way in the scriptures where it is said that if each mantra is repeated thrice, even as the yajna is being performed, it is equivalent to doing the, you know,
whole yajna,
the whole yajna thrice.
And of course, he also says that you have to pay three times the fees to the Brahmins.
Right, that is a nice thing which, you know, which strikes you. But this is the proposal they give him. I'm sure even otherwise that the salary must have been three times.
Even if they had done the other way.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably you'll have to host them for, you know, thrice the amount of time if it was three different yajnas. So when Yudhishthira is asked this, Yudhishthira says, I have no, you know, preference in that matter. Whatever you people choose as the pandits, and as long as it has the approval of Lord Krishna, I don't have any problems in doing it the way you choose to do it. So Krishna has asked that, and Krishna also says that whatever you decide, it has the approval from our side. And they discuss again, and then they come back and said, alright, we'll do it this way. We'll chant three times every offering that we make. We'll make it thrice. And of course, you can pay us three times. The Brahmins say. And that is accepted by all in the court.
And that is how the yajna actually proceeds. You know, I was reminded of how when once or twice we attended the mass marriages that happened at Kulwant Hall, how sometimes Swami would cut short the chief officiating priest, say, no, this is not necessary, do this. And everybody would just accept it. Nobody would ever feel that, oh, you know, we are cutting short an elaborate process, or some things of the ritual are missing, therefore I'm not feeling fulfilled, nothing. The entire fulfillment came simply with the fact that Swami is performing the wedding. I mean, and it was such a joy to watch all the couples united in that feeling, because according to them, if Swami tells, sit here, write her name in the rice and rice grains, and you write his name in the rice grains and your marriage is done, it would be fine for them. I just randomly stated some ritual. But that was how it was. There was nothing like a rigid and fast rule, because having been married, I know when you sit in before that yajna kunda, as per the Bharatiya tradition, it takes hours and hours for the entire ceremony. There are so many rituals to be done. But I don't think any of the mass marriage ceremonies in Bhagwan's presence followed the same rituals, nor all of them had the same time. They would have different timings. Some would get over in half an hour, some will take 2 hours, but none of that matters, because what the Lord says is fine. And so therefore, again, once again, we can totally empathize with Yudhishthira saying that, you know, as long as Lord Krishna says it's fine, that's fine. It doesn't matter, you know, how you do it. Those are all left to you. And again, here when Krishna says that to the pandit, that you decide whatever is fine by you is fine for me, that again reminds us of Swami, because there would be those occasions when Swami would say, no, do it this way, that's it. Mm-hmm. There's no more discussion on that. At the same time, there are also many occasions, not only in yagnas, whether it's our sports meet, whether it's a drama, where Swami would say, no, you do what you feel is fine. So, it is so beautiful when we read Bhagavata Vahini, because all of us have had this beautiful opportunity to be part of Sai Bhagavata, and one can easily relate to the acts of Lord Krishna, because they seem to mirror the acts of our Sai Krishna.
And many times, you know, this is of course a very auspicious account, incident, but many times when old devotees pass away, when they come to Swami would sometimes insist that whatever has to be done as ritual ceremonies after a person passes away has to be done on the 11th day, 13th day. Swami would say, do it as per your tradition, but don't miss it. You have to go to Kashi, go and do it there. In fact, there is that account, you know, when Swami was going to Badrinath,
mm-hmm.
there is one particular place which is very, very auspicious to do Pitru Puja there.
Brahma
Kapal.
Brahma Kapal, yes.
Right, Brahma Kapal is a place where, you know, it's very
at Badrinath it is there,
right?
Yes.
And there Swami insisted that all of the people who came with Swami actually go down to the river Alaknanda and perform that ritual elaborately. In fact, Swami himself went. It seems Swami materialized a ball of vibhuti, put it in that copper vessel and filled water in that. And then Swami materialized those akshatas which they use, I think, right? No? And Swami put that also in til seeds, not akshatas. Til seeds, Swami materialized that, put it in that water. And Swami made all of them do that entire ritual. Because many people believe that you don't know how many ancestors are there for whom we have not done that ritual. So when they go to some of these places, there are some places which are marked out for that. You go and do that Pitru Puja there, which is meant for all your ancestors who have been neglected. So Swami ensured that everybody do that ritual. So it's not that Swami is completely against ritual, but at some times when you go to Swami and say, Swami, what do I do for my father? Swami will say, just feed 9 people, you know, just do Narayan Seva in the ashram. So that, you know, who could say that better than Swami? And, you know, that was the beauty of Swami filtering out, not completely saying that rituals are not necessary. Swami wanted that tradition to be upheld also, but also not be as, as Rabindranath Tagore would say, let's not be lost in dead habit, that kind of a thing.
Absolutely. I think throughout, when we see Swami's life, when we see the different experience of people, one thing that becomes clear is Swami did not want us to fixate or get fixed on anything. Only thing that is worth being fixed on is Swami himself. That's it. So that, with that objective, therefore, then there is nothing like rule. The only rule is what he says. Like how I like how our professor Bhagya from the university would state it. He would say there are two rules in life that you have to remember. First rule is God is always right, and go by what Swami says. Second rule is, if in doubt, refer to rule number 1. You know, that's all. So basically there's only one rule, and I think throughout that is what it is. And because if we do in that manner, just like Yudhishthira's, everything was taken care of. Like how, again, I'm reminded of another thing that one of our professors, this is Dr. Ravi Kumar from the Vrindavan campus, would say that Swami takes care not only of our welfare, but also our farewell. That is what we will see happen to the Pandavas also. Krishna takes care of their welfare as well as their farewell from the earth. So, when we have such a Lord who is ready to take care of everything, let's not be fixed about anything, just let's be fixed in our love for Him. And I think that is the strong message that comes from the Bhagavata Vahini as well.
In fact, you know, that's easier said, especially when you have Krishna beside you, right? Or when Swami was there physically to go up to. And that's why I remember when I joined in Vrindavan, one of the first things the teachers would always tell is, you know, forget everything else. Forget all other things that you can achieve through a spiritual path. The first thing that you should do is establish an inner connect with Swami. He said, because everything else is dependent on that. You know, what ritual to do, what is right, what is wrong. All of that comes only when you're able to
get
ask the question and get the answer. And he said, I mean, they would say that, you know, labor for nothing else, but only for this inner connect. Because once that is there, I mean, everything else is only about obedience. You know, you just have to ask and you have to do what has been told. But till then, you know, this confusion will always be there, right?
And so the yagna is concluded. It is In fact, it is described as being grander than the yagna that Marut had performed. Marut was something that had never happened, and so far again in history, but here it is. So the Ashwamedha yagna performed by Yudhishthira beats, recreates history. It becomes the most grand. Everybody is happy. A lot of sacrifice is done. Literal sacrifice, where you know, gold is given in charity. Food. There is a 24-hour canteen running there. You know, it reminds one of the birthday days of Bhagwan. Throughout the day, people are being fed. So it's a grand success. And once that is complete, everybody returns back to their own kingdoms and to their own homes. And it is at this point in time that Krishna gives the good news to the Pandavas that he has decided to stay on for a little longer before returning to Dwarka. And it's a delight for everyone. You know, when Swami would go to Vrindavan and it's time to return to Parthi, if Swami says that, okay, I'm going to stay 3 more days in Vrindavan, what a joy it would be for us at Vrindavan. And the same thing here, if when the summer comes, Swami has to leave to Vrindavan when we are in Prashanti, if Swami delays by 3 more days, we are so happy. Because we are never satisfied with how much we get of the Lord. And I think that's a good thing to have. Let's have insatiable desire for the Lord and the Lord alone, nothing else. So therefore, when Krishna tells them that I would be staying on for a few more days, the Pandavas are overjoyed. They decide to make the best use of the opportunity available and spend time with their Lord Krishna.
In fact, we're going to listen to something similar to that even during the Africa trip when Swami stays back.
Uh-huh.
It was not a planned stay. Swami's stay gets extended and the kind of joy which that creates. And probably the Pandavas would not have been aware why this extra grace was being given to them. But you know, with the benefit of hindsight, when we know the whole story, we know that this was a very, very precious time that they were getting of Krishna staying back for those few months and, you know, extending his stay after that. Because at the end of it, because we'll come to that when it comes, then finally Krishna takes leave of the Pandavas and he returns to Dwarka. But as a escort, you know, a person, you know, when guests come to us, Swami would say, depending on how close or how intimate that guest is, we would either send them off from the door or till the lift or till the compound, you know. And
yeah, you know, I can really say that. You know, sometimes when guests come home, at the door you tell goodbye.
Right.
For some people you go in the lift, go till down. For some you drop them till the railway station.
Right.
But I think if it's somebody very close, you even go to the extent of traveling with them. And because I see this, you know, my wife's sister, once when she had come and she was a little sick, so my father-in-law, he actually traveled all the way to Bangalore in the taxi with her, dropped her there at her home and then came back. So I think the closer the person is, the greater distance you travel. And that's why Swami would say, finally in the burial ground when the body is being burnt, you know, the spinal cord bends actually. That is a scientific way of saying, but Swami would say that the person would get up to see that now who is there to travel with me, and everybody would have left and gone. It is only the Lord who will travel with you till the destination, and therefore he is the one who is closest to you.
Actually, there's an old film song in Tamil, you know, where they say this, your relatives come till your house, your wife can come till the road, and your son will come till the graveyard, but nobody comes till the end. And I remember when this was quoted in Swami's presence, you know, in Thrai, one of our teachers, when he was speaking, he quoted this song. And Swami was literally, you know, going with that thing, saying that, yeah, nobody comes. And Swami, of course, completed the song is philosophical, saying that nobody comes till the end. But Swami completed it by saying that only God comes till the end, right? Of course, that's an aside, but here the question is about God returning to his own kingdom. Krishna is going back, and of course he is not going to be allowed to go back alone because Arjuna is escorting him right back till Dwarka and going back.
So Arjuna and Krishna leave for Dwarka, and once again now there's a lull at Hastinapura. It often happens. We have experienced that multiple times, be it the Shivratri or Guru Purnima or birthday. Once the celebrations get over, suddenly you feel a kind of a lull, and you know, everybody has returned back. And Swami is also not like in the birthday season, every day, morning, evening, multiple times, you are seeing Swami or with Swami only. Suddenly the birthday season is over. Now morning you have classes, you see Swami only once a day. In that time also you don't know Swami, you will see only for 2 hours. Because other days there are programs, in that sense physically. Swami, you ensure that he's outside in the present. So all that gets reduced. So it's a kind of a lull, and that similar kind of lull envelops Hastinapura. And this lull is broken a few weeks down the line when a rumor starts spreading in Hastinapura. And what is the rumor? The rumor is that Vidura, the half brother of the father of Pandavas, or is he a complete brother? Yeah,
half brother
of the of King Pandu, the father of the Pandavas. He would have actually, you know, renounced the whole world at the end of the war and just gone off. Nobody knows where, how, what he's doing, and everybody would have concluded
before the war begins.
Before the war begins, correct? Right.
In fact, that is one of the, you know, I was just reading in one of the Puranas, they say that there's a conversation between Duryodhana and Krishna towards the end of the war, just before the war ends, where Krishna says the many mistakes that Duryodhana did strategically, you know, forget about the sins and the mistakes. And
not the morality wise.
Yeah, strategies in the war which they did, and one was letting Vidura go. He said because if there was anybody who could match Krishna in stratagem, it was only Vidura. Because he was a very wise man and a minister, and he said you let him go, that was one of the, you know, big mistakes that you do. Because from the beginning, Vidura is very, very upset with the way things are going. We know the story where, you know, he's upset about the incident of the wax house where Pandavas are tried to be killed. And then there is that incident of, you know, the way Draupadi is treated in the court. Vidura is the only person who speaks up against it. Even Bhishma is quiet. The first person to get up and say this is wrong, this is not right, and nothing can justify. You can't say that she has become a slave, now she can do. He said anybody, whoever it is in that place, to treat a person like that is wrong. And the only person who stands up and says that is Vidura. Still he sticks on and hoping to bring some justice to Pandavas. It doesn't happen. Finally, when it comes to a stage where the war is announced,
it's inevitable.
Duryodhana says, we'll have to go for the war. Vidura resigns and goes away. He says, I will not be part of this.
Again, you know, though Krishna tells this to Duryodhana, it reminds one of that Chinnakatha that Swami narrates of how Prahlada is ruling the entire three worlds and Indra wants to usurp back this kingdom so that he becomes the ultimate ruler. And he goes to Prahlada and asks him for his character. And when Prahlada, he says, I just want your character, nothing else. When Prahlada gives up the character, Swami says how he sees fame going, wealth going, because all of them, they say that we are all linked to character. If character is gone, fame will desert you, wealth will desert you, power will desert you, everything will desert you. And once you get back character, all of these return also. No wonder Swami said that the end of education is character. So in that sense, while Vidura matched Krishna in stratagem, he also matched Krishna in his sense of morality. I mean, I think Vidura was the closest to Krishna, because Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says there are four kinds of people who come to me. Artha, Artharthi, Jignyasu and Jnani. And Jnani is the closest to me because he's almost me. And that is what Vidura was. Vidura was a Jnani. So he's the closest the Kauravas could have had to somebody not only as strategic as Krishna, but somebody as divine as Krishna, somebody as wise as Krishna, somebody as whatever Krishna is. And when you're not ready to accept the morality part of Vidura, it is obvious that even if, I'm just feeling that even if Duryodhana had tried to tell him to stay back, Vidura would not have. Because it doesn't come as a separate package. You can't get the Lord's intellect, intelligence and strategy without being ready to accept the Lord's morality.
Right. And apparently in the Mahabharata, Vyasa calls Vidura Dharmaraja first.
Uh-huh.
The title of Dharmaraja is given to Yudhishthira much later. It is Vidura who is referred to as, you know, the king of Dharma. Because we know Vidura Niti is supposed to be the best way a kingdom has to be run. Because he was such a gem of a, you know, he was a gem of a devotee, gem of a person. And more than anything else, he was the father figure for the Pandavas.
So it was almost like after Vidura's retirement, the epithet was given to Dharmaja. To Yudhishthira.
Right, almost like that. And this was the news which was reaching the Pandavas. You know, this Vidura is finally being seen again in the precincts of the kingdom, in the precincts of Hastinapura. And we can understand the joy that must have filled the hearts of, you know, the Pandava brothers. because that was probably the only happy news they could have heard at the end of the war after all that they've gone through. And immediately spies are sent, people are sent to find out whether it's just a rumor or is it true. Because not only was he so fond to the Pandavas, even the people were so fond of him. Because, you know, that's what happens if there's one person who really cares for them. You know, from the people's point of view, you know that. Even in the government, we know that if there is one good minister who's really doing, going out of his way to do good, you really, you know, people...
We support that government in spite of 10 other corrupt ones being there.
Exactly, all the other flaws which are there. Because the people are so fond of him, you know, because the only person who can stand up and say, tell the king that this is right, this is wrong, do this, this is what the people need, that is given to the minister in those days. And Vidura was one such who was so very dear to the people. So they think that maybe the people are just, you know, out of their hope of seeing Vidura again, they're imagining that they've seen somebody and he appears to be like Vidura to them. So the people are sent out to find out whether really Vidura has come. And it turns out that it is Vidura indeed who is, you know, roaming around in the form of a mendicant.
And once the news is confirmed, again there is joy and a lot of preparations are made for the grand welcome of Vidura. Because, as I said before, Vidura is the closest to Lord Krishna. It's almost like Lord Krishna coming. Because he's a jnani and... And yes, he's been a father figure, not only to the Pandavas, to the entire kingdom he's been like a father figure, because he's always had their good in mind, as you said. And so therefore, now in this lull, this is some reason to celebrate. In this lull, there is a reason to celebrate. It's all, so all the people again start, you know, again festoons are put up, archers and things are made ready for a grand welcome. And in fact, Swami writes of how the Pandava brothers themselves take chariots decked with gold in the finest of armors, everything, and they set out in order to welcome Vidura even as he just crosses over into the kingdom, into the capital city. And they go there, and to their utmost, not surprise actually, because this is what they would have expected. Vidura is there in plain bark clothes as an ascetic, a sage. He is just walking by himself, and he seems to be surprised by all this paraphernalia and grandeur that has come to welcome him. It's only out of his love for the people. Just like, you know, Swami never wanted paraphernalia. Swami never wanted all this fanfare. But because it would give joy to us, for our sake, he accepted it. As, you know, Shirdi Baba was there living as a fakir. Because that is how his devotees, that is what his devotees found happiness in. Swami wore the silken robes because his devotees wanted it. Because Swami was also born as poor as Shirdi Baba or as like a fakir. And as we have seen in the Satya 2, when we had that Satyam Shivam Sundaram serial, when we discussed it, we saw how Swami is born in a poor household which could hardly afford two meals a day. But everything that Swami did was for the joy of the devotees. And so he, just as Swami would accept the fanfare and the grandeur, whatever, because the devotees would be happy, I think in that same spirit, Vidura too accepts this welcome and he ascends the chariot and they head towards the palace.
Right, and finally he comes, and by now, you know, Mother Kunti is waiting to meet Vidura, because, you know, from her point of view, she was widowed and she was in the forest. It was completely Vidura's, you know, whatever Vidura did to bring back the children, to ensure that they were safe, to ensure that they were given the right place in the palace, because we know that Duryodhana and his brothers never wanted them, and they were
every single plot that they made to kill the Pandavas, it was Vidura who
only,
actually, huh?
Right, it was only Vidura, and so literally it was, you know, Kunti saw him as a brother who was there to protect her children, so she was very, very happy to see him, and in fact she starts, you know, breaking down into sobs, saying that, Vidura, why did you leave us? You know, when everybody left us, when everybody was trying to harm us, you protected us. And when, you know, finally my children were there to rule the kingdom, you were not here by their side. And she breaks down, and then Vidura starts doing what he was best at doing, giving wise counsel. And I think what he says is very, very important, because, you know, here is somebody, Vidura stands for somebody who was probably the only person who resisted all through what was going wrong, right? But the same Vidura was telling that, Mother, what has to be, what is destined has to happen. you know, nobody can do anything about it.
Who am I to do anything?
We are not able to do anything. But, you know, that is where actually the essence of dharma is. You don't do what you're supposed to do because you can change the course of things which are happening. You do what you're supposed to do
because you're supposed,
you're
to,
supposed
do it.
To do it. You know, that's all it is. And nobody else can say that other than Vidura. You know, Dhritarashtra could probably say the same thing. You know, what had to happen, happened. You can't do anything about it. But he didn't do anything about it. You know, but only a person who actually put his neck out and said that we have to do whatever we can has the right to say this, that destiny can take its course and we just have to accept it.
No, that's a very important lesson, because very often when things don't go the way we want or the things don't go the right way, we put up our hand and say the same thing. We say, you know, it was destined, it was what had to happen, had to happen. But as you said, it is okay for us, or it is fine for us to say that only when we have put in all our best to do the right thing. Without doing anything, without doing, sitting, just sitting by and saying that, you know, if I just sit and say that if I am supposed to be fed today, I will be fed, I will not work. We don't do that, right? I mean, that is the disconnect that we see in today's world. I don't say that I will not go to office, I will not work. If I am supposed to get money, I will get. If I am supposed to get food, I will get. Say, no way, I will work. So when it comes to my own selfish desires, my needs, my attachments, I will go and work. But when it comes to things that I have to do selflessly, I say, no, 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 why should I do it if it's all destined? If I have to, when Swami says, Dina dukhiyon se prem karo, mera sai prasanna hoga. No, 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 it's their karma. They have been like that. What is it? It can't be helped. Whatever I do can't help them, because his karma is to remain poor. His karma is to suffer this disease. This kind of escapism, this kind of double philosophy that we live our lives by is, I think, the cause for disconnect in our life, the cause for discontent in our life. And as you said, Vidura is such an ideal for us to follow, where you do everything not because it will result in something. You do everything because you do your duty, because you are meant to do your duty. Just like the fire is hot and burns, the water is cold and it wets. In the same way, it is my dharma to do it, I do it. Whether it gets success or not. And having done everything, I don't get elated by my success nor frustrated by my failure, because I say what had to happen just happened. There's nothing special about me.
Right. And after that, of course, Mother Kunti asks him, where were you been? I mean, where have you been all this while? You know, you did leave the palace, but tell us about your travels. And that's when Vidura says that he went and visited many, many holy places and shrines. And even as he starts narrating that, all the Pandavas, of course, other than Arjuna who were there, they sit around him and start listening to as he reveals his tales of travels. And Swami says that even as he mentions each of those holy places, you know, Yudhishthira is literally transported there. He closes his eyes in prayer and he says, I also wish that one day I can make these journeys and visit these holy places.
In fact, he makes a mental pilgrimage with Vidura's description itself. He is currently not able to do the travel, but as Vidura is describing, he visits each of those places and his hands fold in prostration. I mean, amazing, you know. It's really amazing when you think of it, because it is not easy to do such things. When you're a king, you have a million things in your mind. Because compared to a king, I don't have that many things in my mind, but I find it hard to do. Even when I'm listening to somebody who is talking about Swami, I'm getting inspired. Even in middle of that, I am able to, you know, my mind travels to some other place. I am thinking of something else. I am thinking of this thing. To get this kind of focus, really, all these people, these heroes whom Swami has written about, are definitely worth being heroes, definitely worthy of emulation. And here Yudhishthira, though he is not physically gone on the pilgrimage, literally does the pilgrimage, getting the same benefit and getting the same feelings as Vidura did. And everyone is eager to know what happened at Dwarka, because they are sure that Vidura has Dwarka also as part of his pilgrimage, because Vidura recognized the divinity of Lord Krishna. So they are eager to know what happened at Dwarka, and especially when they get to know that Dwarka was the final place of culmination of his pilgrimage. So Vidura has gone everywhere and has culminated his pilgrimage in Dwarka, and from Dwarka he is coming to Hastinapura. He will give them more news than Arjuna, who just left. You know, his will be the most recent news. And so they are very eager to know about Dwarka and Krishna, and that is what they ask Vidura.
But, you know, as Swami writes, Vidura very, very craftily avoids that topic. He says that I didn't go there because I didn't want to visit them in this form, in the form of a mendicant, in these robes and in these matted hair. But the fact is, Vidura knows something which others don't know, and he does not want to dampen the spirits of that moment. You know, he says, I've given them so much joy, why should I snatch it away from them? Because a very, very important episode, of course, in this part, Swami doesn't mention it. What happens is, as Vidura is going towards Dwaraka to probably have the opportunity to see Krishna one time, he actually meets Uddhava on the way. And that's how he comes to know about the fact that Krishna's avatar has actually come to an end.
The physical departure,
physical departure of Lord Krishna. The details will come later where Swami speaks about that when Arjuna comes back. Because that's what Vidura thinks, that Arjuna is with Krishna and Arjuna will come back with the news anyway. So let them not know it till Arjuna breaks the news to them. But what exactly happens there is actually, you know, even there when Krishna is departing, is actually one of the people he thinks of is Vidura. Because the story goes that I think Krishna imparts the ultimate knowledge to Uddhava, because Uddhava is one who is a jignasu. You know, other than, we know that story of how Krishna sends Uddhava to Vrindavan to learn the value of bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
Because Uddhava is actually one who is always, you know, engrossed in the thinking of Atmajnan and all of those things. So before Krishna departs, Krishna gives the ultimate wisdom to Uddhava, and Uddhava has actually become a realized soul and tells Uddhava that as you go, you will meet Vidura, and Vidura also deserves to receive this knowledge. But you will not give it to him. Ask him to go to sage Maitreya, who will give it to him.
Hmm.
And imagine, at the point of departure, Krishna actually thinks of this one soul, and that is Vidura, and thinks of his ultimate liberation or whatever it is.
You know, if we just look at this episode, there's one more interesting point that comes to mind, that when the avatar is leaving, physically leaving the sojourn on earth, the avatar thinks of the jnanis and the jignasus. So though Krishna has said that four kinds of people come to me, artha, that is one who is in trouble, in distress, artharthi, one who is seeking power, fame, whatever, glory, jignasu, one who is eager, seeking knowledge, and jnani, the realized one, the wise one. These are the four kind of people who seek me. But if we turn it the other way, these are the four kind of people who seek Krishna. But whom does Krishna seek? Krishna seeks the jignasus and the jnanis. I think that should be inspiration for us, that in our life, if at all we seek anything, we have to seek God and knowledge. These are the only two things worth seeking. It's not worth going to God for solving our problems, nor is it worth going to God for getting greater glory, money, power, etc. Because Krishna also, as you rightly said, he thought of one jnani, which is Vidura, and one jignasu, that is Uddhava, before he left. So, coming back here, Vidura therefore doesn't give them even a slightest hint of what has happened. He in fact covers it up. He says that, I'm actually not interested. I have given up all ties, all bondage. I don't have anything like family, kith or kin. So, because Vidura belongs to the same clan, he would have had relatives, relations all around. He says, I didn't go to anybody's home, anywhere. It is, I don't know, but I have a very, very special corner in my heart for you, Pandavas. I just could not go away without meeting you. That is why I have come. And when he tells this, the question about Dwarka is forgotten temporarily. The Pandavas rejoice that they are so blessed that they have won the love of their uncle Vidura in this manner. And they spend a nice time talking to each other and, you know, sharing their affection and warmth. After which, again, in order to ensure that he doesn't make Yudhishthira feel bad, Vidura decides to accept the hospitality in the palace itself and retires for the evening in one of the grand sections of the palace.
Right, and even as, you know, Vidura is lying there, Vidura knows things which others don't know. As, you know, one thing is, he knows that the avatar of Krishna has come to an end, but he is not able to sleep there, because, you know, with this knowledge, he also knows that in the same palace still lives Dhritarashtra and Gandhari.
His other,
you know,
brother.
His other brother, and who has been the cause for all this, you know, calamity which has occurred. And he also knows that he is being cared so very well by the Pandavas. Because as we know what happens after the war, you know, all the 100 Kauravas are vanquished. But Yudhishthira says that, you know, you are my father, you are like my father, and you don't have to go anywhere, you will be still be taken care of in the same way you were cared for when, you know, Duryodhana and the others were alive. And that's what happens, and Yudhishthira is taking very good care of, you know, Dhritarashtra and Gandhari. But this thought of, you know, what will happen to these two, this couple, who has still not given up the attachment to the body and comforts. Because he knows Krishna has gone, and it's just a matter of time before Pandavas also go away. Because he knows that they will not hold on to their life once they get to know the news.
Mm.
It's only a matter of time before Arjuna comes back and tells the news to them, and these people leave. Then he says, what will happen to these people? You know, it's not about who will care for them. Obviously, Yudhishthira is going to tell who is going to, you know,
take care of them.
But even after all of this, if they don't embark on the spiritual journey, you know, what is going to happen to them? You know, it's literally probably that desperateness which a guru will have. Because as we know, Vidura has really reached that ultimate stage. He's not thinking as a brother, he's not thinking as a minister, he's not thinking as a well-wisher, but literally as a person who knows, you know, the desperate situation of jivatma
of a soul that is floundering in the samsara,
which is so lost in the samsara, and there is a certain sense of urgency and desperateness which he feels in the need to counsel counseling Dhritarashtra and Gandhari and having them embark on a spiritual journey at least now after all this.
That is why it is also said that a true guru is the one who has true love, because that love is not for the body, not for the mind, but that love is for the soul. And that is the kind of love I think Vidura feels towards Dhritarashtra, and he decides that right now I have to get up, go and I have to advise my brother, whatever, I have to advise this soul, I have to bring peace to this soul. And right away he gets up from his bed. But I think right now we don't have the time to go into that, because the clock in our studios is showing the time as 1:59. So dear listeners, this is where we will conclude today's afternoon satsang, as Vidura rises from his bed and decides to walk over to his brother's chambers in the same palace. We will continue with this next week, because next week too is part of this fortnight on the Bhagavata Vahini. We are grateful to Bhagwan for all the love, for all the inspiration, for this wonderful opportunity to sit and think about him, contemplate on him, and contemplate on the beautiful works that he has left behind for us. Both Prem and myself offer our humble salutations at his lotus feet. And dear listeners, as always, any feedback, any question, any thing that you wish to share regarding this, what we are doing, or regarding what we have done any time in the past, you can write as always to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram. We will be concluding with a song, on the other side of which will be the segment Love to Love.
सेवा का जुनून तेरा सबको धारा प्रेम और सेवा का पाठ पढ़ाया ओ साईं तुमने राह दिखाया दिन दुखियों के तू ही सहारा भजनों ने तेरा सबको धारा तेरे चरणों में रहे मेरा मन तेरे चरणों में रहे मेरा तन अंतर्यामी सबका स्वामी साई कृष्णा मेरे भगवान अंतर्यामी सबका
सबका स्वामी।